tomatoes. You grew tomatoes first in Preston's? We grew tomatoes in
Canley Vale, then in Green Valley, then in Preston's. I grew tomatoes back in 1954 when we, I think, yes, it was 54 when we grew our first crop of tomatoes in Kookaburra Road.
And how did you get your sticks supplied? What kind of that?
When we first started farming, we didn't know of any other sticks, but bush sticks. We used to go out to Appin and Douglas Park, and sticks after a there was bushfires prevalent in those days around Sydney, and a few years after the bushfires, these tomato stakes, the wattles, used to grow like hairs on a dog's back. They were so thick, and we'd go in there and clear a pathway and start cutting. Somebody would be cutting, putting them on heaps. Somebody would be carrying them and putting them on the back of the truck, and by the end of the day, we would have a full load, maybe 4,000 or 5,000 sticks on the back of the truck, and away we go. I was the billy boy in those days, and I used to stack the tomato sticks on the back of the truck, and they were the only thing I did object to was having to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to be out there at daybreak at Douglas Park or Appin or wherever we were going, and the day was a full day, and you slept well after that day when you went out cutting sticks, I can assure you.
So,
but we didn't get on to tomato sticks to well in the 50s when the co-op was opened and sawmills started to supply their square sticks. Before that, was mostly wattles. And we used to go as far as Kurrajong Heights to cut these wattles.
So who supplied your water in those days?
City water, mostly from the meter. And once the farm was established, if you had a good spot to build a dam, well, you would put a dam and a pump on, because water was expensive even in those days. And it was slow. If everybody used the water, the pressure dropped. You'd be there all day with the hose, and you couldn't do any other work. So if you had a pump, you would do it in, say, 2 or 3, 4 hours, and then you was able to do other work on the farm besides watering tomatoes. But then you could spray, you could prune, you could do whatever else you wanted to do for the rest of the day.
And you'd bag the Early tomatoes,
we had under bags. We used to make beds around about a chain in length, which accommodated around about 20 to 25 tomato plants. We had wires to go over the plants, like a sort of a tunnel, and then you would tie the bag onto we sewed the bags together to make up the roll, and we would sew the bags onto the wires and onto pegs at the end of each bed, and we had double bags early in the piece. But then later on, we decided that unrolling and rolling bags every morning and every night, that single bags facing the sun would be sufficient. And it was sufficient while the plants were smaller, but if they got a early frost and the plants were fair size, the frost would get the tops and would inhibit their growth. But you got away with it. That's the main thing, and you got away with quite a bit of work folding and unfolding the bags.
What about with the cabbages?
Our cabbages were they were grown on raised beds, usually the double size of a tomato bed, where you could plant 4 to 6 rows of cabbages, where you only planted one row on either side of the bed for the tomatoes. But cabbages, they could stand a bit more water, and if it rained heavy, and the tomatoes wanted plenty of water but good drainage.
Was there a bumper crop, or a few of them, or?
Well, there was some bumper crops when we got the was when we first started growing tomatoes. It was the old red China tomatoes, a crinkly one, a soft tomato, but a beautiful eating tomato. Then came the Rouge Marmande, which was a harder tomato, but an early cropper, smoother skin. In the first few years, we got bumper crops, but the price wasn't what you called excellent. And then the smooth skin tomato would come out. I just forget the name of that smooth skin, but it was a beautiful big tomato. It grew prolifically, and it grew right to the top of the sticks. And there were some bumper crops, but boy, we flooded the city markets some years with those, because everybody got good crops.
Where did the food go?
Into Sydney markets. And then we tapped the Melbourne market through when we established the Leppington Growers Cooperative. We sent tomatoes to the Melbourne markets, because we were flooding the Sydney markets. Agents used to come in from Melbourne, buy up cheap, go down and sell dear. So the growers thought, well, there's an opening for us down there if only we could get the tomatoes in an orderly fashion to the Melbourne markets. And, of course, the growers got together, and Leppington Co-op was formed. Each grower contributed £20, and that was sufficient to start the co-op building and the produce side of it. One must remember that £20 didn't sound a lot, but when you had a couple of hundred odd growers all contributing, it became a substantial amount, even in those days. And we were able to start the co-op going, and we were able to purchase sprays, fertilisers, and tomato stakes later on through the co-op. And originally the co-op sold paints and different things like that, but it wasn't successful. We then only concentrated on sending tomatoes to Melbourne and fertilizer and hardware like shovels, picks, and all that sort of thing.
Can you remember the first? Can you name some of those first growers, that first members of the, some of the families?
Oh gosh, yes. There was the Botoviches, the Tooliches, Aniches, Mr. and Mrs. Antichevich. There was growers like Joe Gilevich from Bonnie Rig. They joined in the co-op at a later date. There was many, many. It's hard to remember all their names because there was over 200 odd members in the co-op when we were at our full.
Was it a Croatian or was it?
No. There was quite a number of Croatians, but there were Serbs, there was Montenegrins, there was Australians in the co-op. We had one or two Maltese. We had the gentleman that I mentioned yesterday that was on the board of the co-op, and I can't think of his name. He was a Frenchman from New Caledonia, and I do believe he did go back to New Caledonia, but I just don't know. I can visualise him. I was very good friends with him, but for the life of me, I just cannot remember his name because we were brief acquaintances for a couple of years, and then, of course, he went away, and I had other things to worry about than worry about who was coming and going in the co-op.
So could we talk about your reign at the co-op? When did you run the co-op, or what was your involvement leading up to
it? Well, the co-op was, excuse me, the co-op was formed and it went pretty well for about 3 or 4 years. And then we discovered that things weren't going as well as they could have been, due, I think, to the fact that the personnel we had weren't familiar with the retail side of things. So the co-op went backwards. And the bank that we had at the time decided that they were going to put a stop to the co-op by putting in receivership. The members objected to this, and we called a meeting of the co-op at Leppington Hall, and we decided that we would try and save the co-op. And at the meeting of that at Leppington, I was appointed that night the chairman of the co-op, replacing Mr. Langdon. And then I called a meeting for the next Sunday morning at the Leppington Hall again, put it to the membership that we had to raise in the vicinity of 5,000 odd pounds in order to save the co-op. Each member pledged their support by contributing checks, money, and we collected sufficient funds on that Sunday morning for me to go to the solicitor the next morning, that was on the Monday, to say, right, we've got the funds, please stop the receivership of the co-op. We want to continue. And that was my first involvement. Of course, I was a member of the co-op, but that was when I was deeply involved with the co-op, trying to save it because of the Melbourne market. We did save it by putting on to pay back the members that contributed over a period of the next 2 or 3 years. We put on a levy of so many shillings per case, tomatoes going to Melbourne, and that way we paid the membership back and the co-op was able to continue to trade. And it traded for quite a number of years until Mr. Bakarich, Steve Bakarich, retired from the co-op and the position became vacant. And I was retired from the farm. Not retired, but yes, I suppose you could call it that, because I had a poultry farm and quotas came into the poultry business, and my farm was decimated to the point where I had 10,000 chickens laying in the sheds one day, and then found out that by the time the quotas came in, I had 5,300 chickens, and it wasn't a viable proposition. So I got out of the poultry, and I was a free agent. Mr. Bakarich retired, and I put in for the job. And in the wisdom of the board at that particular time, they thought that they would employ me. I took over the co-op from Mr. Bakarich and continued trading. And by the time the co-op, the membership, one must remember why the co-op was sold, was the fact that the growers that were young and growing tomatoes back in the 50s were becoming old men in the 70s. And due to the diminishing membership, the remaining members decided that it was time to sell the co-op. And I managed the co-op there for almost 12 years and finished up in the hands of John Wellard and his family. I do believe they're successfully still running the business. And it was a fairly good business at the time, going towards the $3 million turnover, which wasn't too bad for a place that was selling produce, fertilisers and alike for the district.
What was the politics like?
Politics didn't enter into it. We as tomato growers, farmers, had a common goal. That was to better ourselves, get the best price we could, go to the best markets we could, and we spoke to one another about bettering ourselves, how we can improve transport, how we could improve different things in the co-op. That politics, although there was various people in there from different parts of the Yugoslavia at that time, and hardly ever entered into it. I got on well with everybody at the co-op, and yes, there was harmony. there was harmony. Very seldom did you have anyone discussing politics, unless they were politics of the local variety, state politics or the federal politics, but hardly did we ever enter into politics from the old country. But there was, you could tell in, there was a little bit of undercurrent, but it never entered into the running of the co-op.
And with considering the politics here, in local, state and federal, were there any politicians that were particularly, you know, committed to what you were doing over that period? Does anyone stand out? Any events stand out as negative or positive?
Gough Whitlam, he was very interested. He opened the cooperative in 1957 when it was built, and Gough took an interest as a federal member for Werriwa, for the farmers. When we had the problem of receivership, Gough did try to help us, but it was not in his province. It was a cooperative scheme under the state government. And he was not able to, although he did his best to help us get through our problem, he just couldn't assist us to the point where he would have liked. He was a person who took interest in the co-op and the running of the co-op and the problems that the farmers had to try and solve them. He did his best, but it was very difficult to try and solve, you know, the problems that we had.
So did you always have quite a big membership base?
Yes, quite a big, 200-odd all the time. In fact, it reached almost 300 at one stage. But then as farmers give away growing vegetables and tomatoes and that, they went to other avenues. And the age shall not weary them, but in this case it did weary some of the farmers, and they had to give it away. And membership did diminish towards the end when I was the manager of the co-op. We had nowhere near the huge meetings we had when we were sending our crops to Melbourne or anywhere of that nature. But there was still substantial membership. And when it was sold, all the proceeds were divided amongst the members. We didn't get a huge amount, but it was reasonable for the investment, and it was reasonable for the fact that we got the benefit of the better price of Melbourne market. And
how significant do you think the co-op played in the community in terms of its cohesion?
It did play a big part in the cohesion of the district. As I said before, there were, like, we were all had a common goal, and we decided that confrontation is no good. We better cooperate, where the cooperative came in, and we helped one another out as much as we could, communicated with better methods of farming and things like that, and yes, it was quite good.
What changes in farming did you see over this period? Because there would have been significant changes. I'm not expecting you to talk about all of them, but some of the impacts of change.
The impact that I saw in the latter years was the fact that bags went out of existence. Tomatoes were grown at a later time, and I think it was more or less not to coincide with the crops coming in from Queensland. Irrigation was different. Trickle irrigation came in. Then the little nipples came in to irrigate the tomatoes. And people were able to do other work while they were irrigating their tomatoes. And yes, it was instead of growing tomatoes and planting them in June, they were planting them in September after the frost, and without bags and all that sort of thing, although there were still some growers with a bag crop here and there, but not a lot.
Did families tend to continue with the farming?
Some did, but it was hard work, and the young ones, there wasn't the income that you could get out outside, like if you went and worked for yourself in the building trade or in some other avenue, or even if you went to work in an office. There wasn't the income on the farms that you could get from outside, and besides that, it wasn't a regular income on the farm. You sometimes had to wait 6 months before you got anything, and when your weekly wage was coming in, you was a bit more content.
So you did other things?
I did go into poultry for a period of about 10 years, but it was an up and down industry. It was a bit more secure than tomatoes, due to the fact that each fortnight the egg board used to drop in a cheque. Even though it wasn't a huge amount of profit, the cheque was there. At least you could cover your feed bills. And
can we talk, about some of that money, like just to get an idea of what sort of margins we're looking at and costs? If you don't mind, like the cost to, if broadly, if that's
the cost of
in a historical sense, so we get a sense of the money. Basically.
In the farming, it was fairly expensive to go into poultry. You had to build the sheds, then you had to stock the sheds, and once you was established and you had a regular income with eggs, it wasn't too bad. But the return per dozen wasn't a huge amount. But even though sometimes you grew eggs at a loss, the check was there at the end of the fortnight and you was able to cover your feed bill and other expenses. Whether you made wages, that was a different story, because a lot of times we did grow eggs for very, very little return.
So the community generally wasn't a wealthy community?
Oh, no. There was an odd one, odd farmer who had a bit of luck. And
what might that be?
Oh, well, you got an exceptionally good crop and an exceptionally good price. Or you may have inherited a farm where you didn't have the expense of building it up or anything like that. There was a few farmers that were a little bit better off than most, but not to the extent that you see farming today, like big combines or big farms with a huge income.
Technology driven,
and yes, but then if you go into look into the broad acre farming now, tractors, I can remember you buying a Fergie for about £1,000. A tractor now, anything up to $200,000 or $300,000, and if you wanted other equipment, it is far in excess of what any one particular person can get these days. Wool isn't like it used to be. Commodity prices for vegetables is not like it used to be. And incomes, although a farmer may look prosperous, sometimes it's only on the surface, but underneath it's a bit dodgy.
So when were your children born, and what are their names?
Margaret was born in 1954, and Glenn was born in 1961, sorry. Oh, there you are, Mum. Thank God you corrected me. yes, Glenn was born in 1961.
And where were they schooled?
Margaret went to Preston's and Liverpool Girls High. Glenn went to Preston's, and Glenn then went to Casula High. And both went on to university, Sydney. Margaret got a degree in education, and now holds a degree in special education and that, and she's a consultant. Glenn went to Sydney University, had got a degree in agricultural economics, and he was the surprise package, because when he said to me, Dad, he says, I don't like the idea of having to work in the office, I'd like the open spaces. What can we do? Glenn, I can't do very much. But then we were fortunate that land got rezoned in Preston's. I got sufficient funds to be able to buy a farm in Tasmania. And as a result, now I'm retired, looking after my dear wife, because she's not well. And Glenn's looking after the farm with his family, two boys and his good wife.
So really, you started to crack a dollar really when the land was... That was the only way, really?
That's correct. I did have a... Well, we were comfortable, but we weren't able to throw dollars about, you know.
You were comfortable in a humble way.
In a humble way, that's right. I was grateful for what I had and happy with what I had, but it was then that I was able to benefit when the rezoning occurred. And
did all the family sell? What happened there with the land for the family? What did John do?
John sold part of his and early, and then continued on farming. I sold ours, and of course, I was unfortunate. Can you cut this?
So when your family sold the land, if we could talk about pricing and how much that sold for, and maybe what some of your neighbours got as well.
Well, yes, land did increase in value, and we were able to negotiate with the developers for certain lands that were not taken up for parks or open space.
Can I just ask who the developers were? Do you remember who they were?
A gentleman by the name of Wise. What was his first name? Mr. Wise developed all the land in the Kookaburra Road area, Currajong Road, and that in that area. Now, when the land was in the process of being rezoned, the alderman told us that all land would be of the same value, irrespective of whether it was to be taken up for parks or whatever utility that the council would require outside of housing land. Now, I did not receive the price that others received in the area. The council took 9+ acres off me and my wife for parkland. We had to argue with the people from Liverpool Council as to the value, and the valuer for Liverpool Council as to the value of that land for the parks. After negotiating for many months, we finished up having to accept $90,000 per acre when the going rate for land in that area was $135,000 per acre. And in that respect, I regret the fact that it was rezoned, due to the fact that my family lost $40,000 per acre, $45,000 actually, per acre, for the land that the council took for the park.
Is that still parkland?
It's still parkland. I believe that the parkland is still open space.
What year was this?
Oh dear, now.
Broadly.
It was in the late 1980s.
So how do those decision makers, do you know how those justify that difference in price?
Well, they got no direction. Once the land, in my case, once the land was rezoned, I had to get the best price I could. Now, with Mr. Wise, I was able to negotiate with him what I wanted for the land, and he agreed to it. And with the council, I had to go in to talk to their property officer, their valuer, and all the officers that go ahead with all that in council, and they knocked my land to pieces. The valuer for Liverpool City Council told me that the dam on my place was big enough to sail the Queen Mary, and therefore the land wasn't as good as the land that didn't have a dam on it. But when you look at the land on the other side of the barbed wire fence, there was my dad's dam that was 10 foot deeper than my dam, and yet they were able to put houses on that particular land, and not only single story but double story houses, and the developers were able to fill the dams in, consolidate the dams, and those buildings are still standing. In my case, it was for parkland. Now, if the council couldn't do anything with the dam for parkland, well, at least they could have put in goldfish, and it would have been something to be looked at if anybody walked around.
So
But now I regret that that part was not a fair thing, where the land values are concerned. If land is to be rezoned, it should all be rezoned, and one price for Tom and one price for Harry, it's the same price, not discriminate between a barbed wire fence and say this land is worth more than this land.
Sounds to me like because it was going to be council land that they undervalued it. So
well,
that
was the case, yes. That was the case. When actually, when in the process of rezoning, the aldermen of Liverpool Council told the landholders that the land would not be discriminated against. I was disappointed in that respect that I was one of the losers, unfortunately. I didn't, well, I lost, but my family lost, because we could have done a lot more with...
significant amount of money.
With that amount of money, that's right, at that particular time. But anyhow, that's past history, so we better...
So you've moved on with that, but
so
it's
we move
painful.
On.
It's a genuine concern.
It is, because when...
You've worked hard, you've fed the...
Well... yes, that's right. I worked that land in Preston's for 44 years before it was rezoned. Other people were fortunate that they only bought a couple of years before and finished up with a huge amount of money. And the people that developed the district in Preston's finished up with a smaller amount. But anyhow, as we said, that's past history. So we've got to live with it, and I have lived. I have lived with it.
And you're alive.
And I'm
you
alive.
And killed you.
No. It hasn't killed me. I'm thriving.
So we're going to wind up soon because you've spoken for a bit. And you've covered quite a lot. I'm just wondering whether there's anything else you want to talk about.
How about we go fishing this afternoon?
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Is that off?
We'll turn it off. So let's just try and think of something to finish off with. Like, so maybe you left Preston's and where you've... How's your life been since Preston's?
Very good. You can record
yeah.
now if you...
Yeah.
My life, I came down to Tasmania, followed my two children. Glenn used to come down on holidays and he loved the state very much. Margaret used to come bushwalking and admiring the scenery through the wilderness of Tasmania. And she finally settled in Evandale. Glenn settled on the farm we purchased outside of Longford, between Longford and Cressy. And, of course, there was only myself and my wife living in the house. We then had a house in Camden for about 3 years. And we used to travel frequently to Tasmania. And we got to the point where we thought, well, it's ridiculous for us to be travelling four or five times a year backwards and forwards when we could be settled with the children in Tasmania. And we finished up at this place in Longford here, and I've been very happy. I've had a few years that I was able to go and help my son on the farm, which I enjoy. And I'm sorry I can't go out more frequently now, but I'm happy where I am. I like Tasmania. It's a bit colder than it used to be in Liverpool. But, Yes, it's a state where it's where Liverpool was 40 years ago, back in the small town of Liverpool. Of course, now I go back and visit my relations that are still in around Preston's, and boy, oh boy, when I see the traffic, I say thank God for Tassie. I'm going back there.
Just can I ask you, what was some of your, what was John like as a brother to you? How was your relationship?
Very good. John and I never argued. We had a very good relationship, a happy relationship, and we would help one another as much as we could, and go out with the families as much as we could. And I couldn't have wished for a better brother. He was a wonderful person, and well, I regret that he's not here.
You're a very hard-working family.
John, a hard worker, always was. I used to help him on the farm in Green Valley, and in Preston's he used to help me also. And yes, we both done our fair share of heavy work. But we weren't none the worse for it. I'm now feeling my knees are not as good as they could be, but I get by, and I'm happy that I can still see my daughter and my son and his family, two grandsons, and yes, life's not too bad.